Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
But this place is different. Special. The others don't want to talk about it because it scares them. But we all know it. We all feel it.
Do you really think all this is an accident? That we, a group of strangers, survived? Many of us with just superficial injuries? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, Jeff?
The island.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back!
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast. My name is Dave Gonzalez and I do not know my blood type.
My name is Joanna Robinson and I also do not know my blood type.
And I'm Neil Miller, and if you gave me three guesses, I don't even think I could get to the right letter, let alone whether it's positive or negative. I have no clue. I would have to text my mom is what would have to happen.
And you are listening to the podcast for season one, episode 20 of Lost. It is called Do No Harm. It is a very bittersweet episode, and it is also a Jack episode. I don't know if those two things are necessarily always connected, but this one, has some big turns, some big developments on the island. If this is your first time joining the show, you should know we're a Lost Rewatch podcast that divides our each podcast episode into two sections. One's called The Calm. That only has discussion up through season one, episode 20, Do No Harm, and not beyond that. Even though we know Lost went for six seasons and aired a while ago, and all those thoughts are sequestered in something called The Storm in the second half of the podcast, behind some SpongeBob trap remixes and sounds of a jungle monstrosity. And then you could jump off for that if you don't want to be spoiled and are watching along for maybe the first time. Everybody loves Lost, except for some reason some people don't like Lost. It's we used to be a Game of Thrones podcast called Storm of Spoilers. As a matter of fact, you could still support us at patreon.com/stormofspoilers and get a whole bunch of bonus content, including a weekly podcast from us that's not about Lost but other pop culture things. Because we used to, jump around and do other big pop culture vacations and tours. It was off-season tour is what we used to call it. Well, I want to announce now that we've clarified how we're going to tour for Star Wars this year. We've mentioned it before, but now we're getting close to the actual date, because if you look, we're at episode 20 of Lost, so we're getting towards the end of the first season. Are we going to take a lot of time off between the first season and the second season, Neil?
Nope, not at all, Dave. We're going to go right into season two in October after we finish season one. And then around Thanksgiving, we're going to stop and take a little month-long break to do our Star Wars series. And so basically between the two holidays, between Thanksgiving and Christmas, we will be doing Star Wars every week, counting down to the Rise of Skywalker. And that'll be sort of our holiday break. And then we'll come back in the new year and continue. I believe we'll be like 6 episodes deep into season 2 by then, which, so it's kind of fun because season 1 here, as we're about to see, we're going to want to get right to the next episode. So, it's going to be fun.
Unlike Lost, you won't have to wait months to figure out what happens directly after the season 1 finale. And that season 1 finale also is a 3-part episode that we are going to do one podcast about. So it's going to be a lot of Lost.
If you have any long like holiday flights planned for like Thanksgiving, it's going to be like a 5-hour podcast.
It's going to be fantastic. And then, you know, come and join us for the various holidays, various American holidays, various American, usually Christian-based holidays. Man, I'm really just following a weird tube down here. But the important thing is it's Star Wars season. Come join us for Star Wars season for some Star Wars podcasts in between season 2 episodes of Lost. That way, I feel like if you do go to patreon.com/StarWarsSpoilers, you could be supporting us if you like Lost. You could be supporting us if you like Star Wars. You could just be supporting us doing podcasts about things that we like. That's where you go to do that, including getting like bonus interview content if you really like Lost with some of our guests recently, which have been amazing and definitely worth a subscription at patreon.com/StarWarsSpoilers. Enough for me. Joanna Robinson, do we have any reviews of our delightful show this week?
Yes, we do. And thank you guys so much for writing in. We really, really appreciate your feedback. You know, if you want to drop us a review on iTunes, what we like to say is that if you leave us 5 stars, you can say whatever you want. And I will read that abuse out loud and, you know, it'll be a fun time for everyone.
We'll all have a good time.
Yes.
But this, and we got a bunch of new reviews. Thank you so much. I feel like every time we read like a negative review, people are really nice and flood us with some, you know, 5-star reviews. So thank you guys. We got a bunch of those. I really appreciate it. So I will read, this one from Veruca. And ACL, so Veruca Salt. I can't believe I'm finally writing a review 5 stars. Being a loyal Android user, there are a few things about Apple that appeal to me. However, the one thing that always rankled about not having an iPhone was that I was never able to leave a 5-star review for my favorite podcast. So imagine my delight when I realized that the iPad I just bought my 6-year-old to use as an AAC device could double as a vessel for this review. I discovered the storm while I was waiting for season 7 of Thrones, and I was a bit apprehensive. After all, aren't we all kind of conditioned to avoid spoilers at all costs? But by the time the new season began, along with the introduction of the Calm Storm format, I was ready to ride the storm out. The hardest part about Game of Thrones ending, yes, even harder than actually watching it, was saying goodbye to my weekly podcast lineup, of which I had grown so fond. And so I took up watching Lost, and I'm pretty into it, but even more so, I'm into listening to these 3 wonderful hosts share their thoughtful and honest takes. Never change, y'all. So thank you guys. Thank you so much. Thanks to all of you.
That was so delightful.
It was really lovely. So if you don't have an Apple device and you want to leave us a review, I'm just saying, like, buy your child an expensive Apple product and then use that. So thanks for your consult.
I approve of all of that.
So I have other things to do in this section, which is that if you want to, leave us a review, as I said, you can do that. You can, to find out more info about the podcast generally, including, I think we'll have a schedule up of all those dates that Neil was talking about in terms of when we're doing Star Wars, when we're not, over at stormpodcast.com. You can go to Twitter at stormpodcast to tweet at us. And if you want to email us, you can email us hosts@stormpodcast.com. We got a bunch of great emails this week. And I am going to, and several of them were about the bean discussion we had, in the numbers episode. And so I'm just going to read, from one of them, from Melissa. So, you know, if you too had some questions about the number of beans,
4 billion beans.
That Hurley or Leonard's wife, right? That's his name. No. Never mind. I don't want to get in trouble. The lady with the bad Australian accent.
What was the damn guy's name?
I can't remember his name. The lady with the bad Australian accent said her husband, who died, tried to guess a jar of beans using the numbers. And so we're like, all the numbers? Or I think that was Dave going, like, all the numbers? So we had several people write in who did some math to try to calculate how big a container would need to be to contain 4 billion beans or whatever. So this is from Melissa, who majored in physics. So applied her physics major to this problem.
I am here for this content.
She used dry uncooked pinto beans because she happened to be cooking pinto beans for dinner at the time. She filled 1 cup mason jar with these dry beans after ensuring the jar was a true cup by measuring a cup of water with a steel measuring cup and pouring it into the jar. She then counted the beans and found that there were 572 beans in this 1 cup. Without getting into the exact details of the calculation, she extrapolated the volume required to house 1 billion beans, 1,748,252 cups, or 109,266 gallons, or 413,615,796 milliliters. She then calculated the size cylinder that would that could hold the volume of beans, assuming that container was Dave was picturing was cylindrical, and that the diameter was and height were equal. With those constraints, she calculated that the cylindrical vat of equal diameter and height that could house 1 billion pinto beans would be approximately 26.5 feet in diameter, 26.5 feet in height. This is smaller than she thought it would be. She hopes that helps. So,
so wait. If I know what I know about volume, it would, in order to fit the 4 billion beans, it could be 26 point whatever things wide, but it would have to be 4 times as tall.
Alex, who also wrote in about the beans and titled his email, Those Fucking Beans, came up with 4.8 billion beans would fill 6.8 Olympic pools. And if you counted 2 beans a second without stopping, it would take you 76 years. Oh,
okay. So if you stacked the 6 pools on top of each other.
Right.
That's a lot.
The one with the bad Australian accent. It's a building-sized container. The one with the bad Australian accent in the episode numbers said the container was the size of a pony. So, like, first of all, I've never described something as the size of a pony. That's just not a, like, unit of measurement I've ever used in my life.
Yeah. How big is a pony?
Secondly,
would be my next question.
Secondly, then that's definitely not 4 billion beans. That means, like, he used the numbers, I don't know,
like, 48,000.
Did he subtract some numbers? Did he just use some of the numbers? Like, that's the real question. So, anyway.
New question. How many beans does it take to make a pony?
Yes. Someone please calculate how many beans it takes to make a pony, and we can see how exactly.
Reverse engineer those into the correct numbers.
So, thank you all for your emails. They're all great. We got another one about, someone who has tried several times to watch Lost and is finally doing it with us. So that's really gratifying. And then when we are done talking about this episode, or I guess when we're halfway through talking about this episode, Do No Harm, we have a great guest on the podcast, Emily Vandervoof, who's a tremendous cultural critic over at Vox.com, is here to talk to us about Lost. And I believe at the time Lost aired, Emily was holding it down at the AV Club, though I'll have to double check. So she has
That's
some,
actually
like,
where I read a lot of my like early Lost stuff was the AV Club.
So, you know, like she's got her bona fides in terms of like
classic.
She was definitely covering Lost when it was airing, which I think none of us were. Maybe Neil was. I don't know.
Not at first, not until later seasons.
So there you go. So stay tuned to hear from Emily. And that is all from me.
Neil, remind us what happened this tragic celebration week on the island.
Well, Do No Harm, as you know, real mixed bag of emotions. This episode is one of the 26 episodes directed by Stephen Williams, who's the second most prolific Lost director behind Jack Bender. It's written by Janet Tamaro, who only wrote one episode of Lost, this is it, but did go on to create the TNT show Rizzoli and Isles, which I remember watching commercials for, but I don't think I ever watched. But I'm told it was quite good. This episode, Do No Harm, aired on April 6, 2005. It takes place on days 41 and 42 on the island in flashbacks.
Woo, 42! Bop, 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 bop. Sorry, this is, we can finally do that. I have to get used to that.
In flashbacks, we meet Sarah, the woman Jack miraculously fixed. He promised he would fix her, and he did. Now they're getting married in Hawaii, which is very convenient for the show Lost. Jack, we find out, is also having trouble writing his vows because he's, you know, he's Jack. That's just sort of a Jack thing to do. He later has a heart-to-heart with his father. He figures out his vows, but it ends up being kind of a weird ride, which I'm sure we'll talk about. On the island, we are reminded in the previously on that John Locke brought back a really messed up Boone and then skedaddled out of town. We open with Jack promising Boone that he's going to fix him. I wonder how many of you saw the ending coming. Elsewhere, while getting supplies for Jack, Kate comes upon Claire in the jungle, and guess what? It's baby time. Even elsewhere-er on the island, Saeed is taking Shannon on a date. They have a lovely time, and Shannon talks about how she's ready to let go of Boone, who is dying elsewhere. Before he departs for a future on the Vampire Diaries, Boone tells Jack about the hatch. Don't forget that. That's important. And then later, Jack almost amputates Boone's leg with a metal door, but then Boone lets him off the hook. He dies as Claire's baby is successfully delivered by Kate. It all ends with Saeed and Shannon returning to a happy camp and some very bad news. Jack then takes off to find John Locke and accuse him of murder.
Murder! Island murder!
Fun fact this week, as Kate is getting back up after falling and breaking the alcohol in her backpack, she can be heard mumbling the word fuck under her breath. Mm-hmm. Sorry for all the kids that are in the room. This, I believe, is and probably cats. The only F-bomb on Lost.
Sorry.
Poor kid just wanted to play with his iPad and then clicked on the previously opened apps, and now here he is, listening to the storm.
Gotta learn sometime. This week's opening question, Boone's final words to Jack are, tell her I, and we assume he's talking about Shannon. What do you think he wanted to say to Shannon? Let's start with Dave.
Love her.
Okay. Love. He loves her. Joanna?
Tell Shannon I was faking it.
I think he wanted to be like, tell Shannon I found a plane. Just utilitarian, right to the end. Tell Shannon I think Saeed's kind of okay. So, tell him I said I was sorry.
Tell Shannon my final words were anyone but Saeed. Just put the last twist on it there psychologically.
Boone goes out on a weirdly racist note.
Yeah, a lot happened this week on Lost outside of our, you know, framing story where we flash back into a flashjack, I believe is how I started just referring to it in my notes, as he's putting a tie on someone. We think maybe that person, you know, is getting married, but no, it's Jack who's getting married. And this is the episode where we get to meet Sarah, his wife, who, yes, Neil's right. He does eventually get around to the vows, but in the most Jack way possible.
Well, I think it's funny that this episode is one of, like, I guess the last one did as well. I think we talked about this with Deus. Sorry, I already interrupted you. But, like, with Deus Ex Machina, we talked about how the flashback was, like, intentionally trying to fool us a little. Like, oh, is this how Locke got paralyzed? Is this how Locke got paralyzed? And so, like, the fact that we know that Jack is not married when Kate meets him, or at least we don't think he's married on the island. I mean, maybe he is, but like he doesn't wear a ring and he hasn't mentioned a wife. And so like the misdirect of thinking that he's the best man, not the groom, And then the question hanging over, like, is he going to not go through with the wedding? Because as far as we know, Jack doesn't have a wife.
Right. And so it sets you up to be in, like, the mindset. So when you actually get to the vows, you're like, we're going to watch Jack jump off that little hill and run off into the ocean.
Right, exactly.
Because I just saw that scene with his dad, and he's not going to do this, is he? Because he's not that dumb, right?
But, you know, if you were Jack, would you take advice from Christian Shepherd? I'm not sure I would. So, you know, fair enough.
You know what else I really appreciate about this? Speaking of, the sort of Jack getting married thing and the way they were trying to throw you off is that this is another really good example. This episode's another good example of how patient they were in season one, especially here at the end, because I feel like they could have maybe given us everything about his relationship with Sarah, but we only get just the wedding weekend. And, I think that that's a good sign for Lost that they're very patiently doling out little bits of the backstory. We're not getting too much, as we go along here. So yeah, that's all I'll say. We don't need to.
Well, I do like, you know, the revelation that not only is Jack's, I need to save everyone complex about a pregnant woman that he watched his dad kill or let his dad, you know, kill through negligence. But, you know, he has this similar complex. It didn't start with it start and end with his dad. There are many layers of Jack feeling guilty and that he needs to save everybody, which deepens him in a way, I think, is just like, I think, yeah, in the first season, I think just piling on another instance definitely deepens, but it helps ease us into Jack's mindset, I think, a little bit more. When I previously did a rewatch of this season for Fighting in the War Room, my other podcast, I was taking out the flashbacks entirely. And doing that, Jack is crazy in this episode. He's just like, I'm gonna cut this guy's leg off. And you're much more on Sun's side, where she's like, coughing up blood.
I mean, I feel like I'm on Sun's side anyway.
Well, I mean, it's even more so where it's like, shouldn't Michael be saying something? Or like, shouldn't everybody be like, Hurley says at one point, like, dude, you're gaunt. But if you watch it without the flashbacks and you have no idea of, like, Jack's, like, weird complex, it's like, there have been a lot of people injured on this island, and Jack usually doesn't react this poorly until he, like, really feels like it's his fault. But he manages to immediately make Boone,
make it someone, like, else's fault, too.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yes, I guess you're right. But, like, making the promise to Boone is like, oh, here we go. And then I think juxtaposing that with the fact that, you know, even once he saves somebody, like, that promise sort of doesn't end for him because he's that bad at managing his own feelings, I guess. I don't know. It works for me, even though it shouldn't. On paper, I feel like it's sort of just replicating a circumstance. Instead of just, like, having a bad father, he has a bad father and, like, a wife he doesn't really love. But I think it works really well with this particular Lost story, which otherwise, I guess, could have just been, like, really drawing out Boone's death. But I think flashbacks counterbalance while also informing.
I don't think we know that Jack doesn't really love Sarah. I think we know that he has doubts about the nature of his affection.
Mostly about himself, which, yeah, also very Jack thing to do.
Yeah, I guess that's another weird part about as this series goes on and becomes, I think, a little bit more sci-fi mystery, and then especially I get knowing what it is and doing a rewatch, like, I guess I'm trying to connect things much deeper than what's actually been said. But you're right, maybe he loves Sarah, maybe Jack's never good at choosing anything.
I don't, have we mentioned yet, I mean, I know we all know this, but should we say out loud, like, that Julie Bowen is playing Sarah, and I don't remember if you said that, Neil, but, like, you know, obviously Julie Bowen has won, like, multiple Emmys for her work on Modern Family, is, like, quite famous now, but at that time, did you guys know who Julie Bowen was? I did, but I'm just curious.
Was she on Dexter before or after this?
I don't think she was on Dexter. I think
she wasn't on Dexter. That's a different Julie.
I think you're thinking of Julie Benz from Buffy.
What else was Julie Bowen?
Well, I watched the TV show Ed, with Tom Cavanaugh.
She was the love interest on Ed.
And then she's also in an iconic episode of Dawson's Creek where Pacey and Joey kiss called Stolen Kisses, where she plays Dawson's Aunt Gwen. But
I don't think I've ever watched that, but I do remember hearing about the one where Pacey and Joey kiss.
Wait, what year was that?
And she played an aunt?
Yeah, 2000. She was like Dawson's cool young aunt. You know what I mean? Like his cool aunt. And they were teens. So, you know, she could have been like in her early 30s. Anyway.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense.
Yeah. So I knew her. I really liked Ed. That's a show definitely zero people ever talk about. Except as like kind of where Tom Cavanaugh broke out. But this Lost came sort of like, right after Ed. And then, before she was on Boston Legal, or right around when she was on Boston Legal, which I never watched, but she's on like 50 episodes of that. So I guess she was like a series regular on that. So, this is your Julie Bowen report. Also, Dave made fun of me before we started recording because I'm about to drop some other cast, trivia on you, which is, Neil was the first one to point out that we should mention the Zach Ward who plays, the Ginger Groomsman, who, fun fact, is the same character that like Jack is defending in that earlier flashback episode.
His, like, okay.
Childhood friend on the playground, same character.
Can't let that guy go either.
That actor, Zach Ward, who Neil and Dave know from a number of things. I know from the Canadian Anne of Green Gables, miniseries. He played Moody Spurgeon. That miniseries is a big deal. Dave was like, oh yeah, nobody knows that, Joanna. But I think a lot of our listeners.
It was a much wittier, barb than that. Carry on.
Was it wittier? I think a lot of our listeners who are of my, like, similar age and, you know, I think a lot of people watched that. So please tell Dave he's wrong about Moody Spurgeon. Thanks so much. Zach Ward. What do you know Zach Ward from, Neil?
Oh, he was in the very terrible Uwe Boll movie Postal, which no one should watch. Don't do that. He was also in Freddy versus Jason.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
He's also one of those, like, that guys.
Yeah.
You know, like, when they need...
That guy Ginger Edition.
Yeah, when they need, like, a ginger.
Ginger with like straight
kind
hair.
Of a nerd. Yeah. Pale guy.
You know who
pale
I get him kind of confused with, and I have to look up his name right now?
This is going to make me feel better for my Julie on Julie violence earlier.
Sean Hatosi. You know who
I'm
from Outside Providence? Anyway, not really confused, but just sort of like for a second, I was like, wait, he's not the guy from Outside Providence, right? Anyway, now that I've mentioned Ed and Outside Providence, I think that I am like feeling, I think everyone's feeling really good.
Are
about
you
my
the most 2004 thing?
Yeah.
<about this episode>. usually I am. Anyway, this episode.
While we're still in flashback land, there was one other thing I wanted to mention, which is, do we have any thoughts as to why Jack just thinks it's acceptable to not roll up his pant legs when he's hanging out with his feet in the pool?
Did he just put his pants in the pool?
Yeah, well, the Christian definitely rolls it up, but in my notes, I'm like, cold feet metaphor too literal.
Oh, That's a really funny
thing. I mean, listen,
though.
Jack's going through some stuff, so we can't expect him to have his fashion game on point. Sometimes you just gotta stick your pant legs in the pool.
I was like, maybe I'm thinking too much about this scene, and then I did my, you know, weekly reread of Lostopedia's episode thing, and their like last one is like
Why are his pants in the pool?
We could talk about that later on in the podcast.
Can you see his bare feet in the pool?
I don't think so. For all we know, he's just like shoes in pool now.
I feel like maybe you can see his shoes like sitting next to him.
Okay.
I'm like looking at photos right now. I'm feeling really perturbed about the fact that Jack just put his fucking legs in the pool.
He's the groom. He could do whatever he wants.
I can't believe I didn't notice that. I was trying to think of something with like Christian and being dead and like Jesus and barefoot and something like that, but I got nothing. This is a bad look.
Jack is a horrible person, exhibit Z.
It's a bad look for my dude, Jack. Also, like Sarah, I feel actually generally pretty neutral on Sarah, so I'm not tipping my hat to like any feelings I have about her, Sarah Shepard generally. But when she gets introduced in this episode, before we see her, you know, Jack's redheaded groom, best man, who I guess was giving his speech at the rehearsal dinner. That's not when you give your best man speech, but that's fine. Like, Sarah just doesn't sound like a lot of fun in this episode. He's like, if you drink, she'll get you. Oh, she'll get you for that, you know? And I'm like, I don't like this, like, picture of a scolding bride sort of thing. So anyway, I don't love how Sarah's introduced is my point. But I feel pretty neutral on her generally. And I like her scenes with Jack, though. I like this.
I mean, let's assume there's a reason for it. Is it like Jack found somebody who's like against drinking as like a way to bolster himself from against becoming his father?
I guess we'll talk about that in the storm.
I like that we don't have to beep things anymore. We're just, things just trail off.
Remember how Jack stuck his pants in the pool?
Most disturbing thing about the episode, Do No Harm.
Yeah. It's not Boone's, like, hamburger pulp chest. It's Jack sticking his pants like a crazy person in the, okay, anyway. All right. Yep. Where are we?
Let's go back to the island to actually talk about trying to save Boone. Sun really steps up as a second Jack here, now that our shadow Jack is crushed to a pulp. I have a question, which is, given how this episode ends, which is Jack accusing Locke of being a murderer, do we think that if Jack knew what had happened to Boone, that he actually would have been able to save him?
This is actually a segment where we've got a few listeners, especially like in our Patreon, who I know have like medical backgrounds or, you know, work in the medical field. And I was actually going to like ask one of them to let us know, like, would Locke's input have made that much of a difference? He's like, his insistence is that Boone was crushed, not like, you know, it's not an impact wound. It's like a wound of being crushed
compartment syndrome.
And also needing to know how far Locke carried him or something like that. And I am curious whether or not that actually would have changed his treatment.
Jack seems pretty convinced.
I mean, Jack also showed himself to be a pretty trash doctor. I mean, the thing that I like about this episode, Do No Harm, right? Because that's the Hippocratic Oath, right? Is do no harm. Isn't it part of Hippocratic Oath?
I mean, it's something, but I don't think it's actually in the actual Hippocratic Oath. I think that might be a misnomer. I'll Google it. Keep going.
First, do no harm. Part of the Hippocratic Oath. Okay.
Nice.
So, you know, so that's,
nailed it.
My parents are medical professionals. So like, so that's a thing, right? Is like, this is the inherent nature of being a doctor, just to do no harm. And we've taken some shots, or at least our listeners who are medical professionals have taken some shots at how Jack conducts himself medically on this island, especially like his interview of Sawyer was not very like medical professional of him. And so I like that this episode.
Not
really,
that Sawyer didn't also deserve it.
I mean, kind of. But I really like that this episode tackles head on the way that Jack lets his foibles, like his dad, lets his foibles get in the way of doing his job correctly here. So I like that.
First, do no harm was not part of the original Hippocratic Oath, but it was added in the 17th century. That's where I got that from. All right, cool. Didn't want to be crazy.
Oh, yeah. Everyone knows that the pre-17th century Hippocratic Oath is the real way to go.
It's like I was sorting through my mind closet and I found this weird adapter. And I'm like, surely I have something to hook up to this adapter.
You are emptying out your storage unit with the big sliding metal door.
Exactly.
Then use to try and cut Boone's leg off.
That makes sense to me. It's brutal, but it makes physics sense.
I like that he's like, go get Michael. I need to figure out some construction way to take off Boone's leg at the knee.
So, yeah, he's like, and Michael like, would have guillotine, to
know,
right?
He's been in construction. He's got to know how to take a leg off.
Michael, show me your drawings. One of these has to work.
And Michael, why isn't Michael more like,
concerned about the whole plot?
No, and why? Anyway, let's praise Sun more. Let's praise Sun's idea to get anemone needles.
Well, she's got a bite down on stick, which is misestimating Sun, and then he should have learned better. And then anemone needles, which is a case number two. And then case number three, he almost cuts the leg off, but she stares him down with the fury of a thousand suns.
Mean, and so that's one good reason to have her involved. In another is that it we have this like Jin and Sun interaction, and like he comes in and he has to communicate and he doesn't like want to even look at her, and it's this whole like dramatic thing. But having her there and Jin over with Claire is like an interesting little parallel. But
yeah, it's also that Sun is the only character that sort of rises above all of these other weird things going on, you know, like she's just telling everybody the truth.
She's willing to treat a disaster like she's a disaster.
She's not even having it from Jin when he walks in. Like, yeah. She just keeps the conversation going. I think it's a great, like, there's a lot of great subtlety in that performance where it's like Sun is constantly eyes on the prize in this episode, and she might be the only one.
I like the scene with Jin. The way it's shot bothers me. I don't know if they didn't have enough space or if the actors weren't all at the same spot at the same time, or if maybe they added a little bit. But like the Sun and Jack are definitely occupying the same space. But then like sometimes I'm not even sure if the Charlie's there because of how it's framed or if Jin was there. But that might be a directorial choice. And it's in like the cave set and walled off within the cave set. So it might be a space issue, but something weird.
We do need to, I like Sun in this role as like, you know, Jack's right hand woman and also knows better than him in some regard. But once again, I'm curious where Sun got her medical knowledge and or like herb lore and or knowledge of anemone spines. I mean, she's married to like Jin would know, but would Sun know? Like, she's married to a fisherman, but he doesn't talk about that. So, like,
well, I mean, she's probably taken a few of those things apart in the last 41 days.
Where's this fancy society lady get her
knowledge? Weren't they eating those?
Probably.
Yeah, sure, so she probably would have cut a couple of them open.
There's just, I wish they had figured out, and spoiler alert, they never do. Figure out a reason why Sun would have medical knowledge, because I think it would be cool. Right. I think it's a cool thing about her here in this episode and some previous things that we've seen, but they don't figure out a way for that to make sense with her backstory. So it's just,
she has a lot of knowledge. She does the garden.
Yeah.
They never really explain like what her gardening thing is. I think it's just like
she knows enough random facts that we could get away with her knowing like enough random facts.
Yeah, but it's vaguely.
If Locke could walk around gooping like, people, why can't Sun be a doctor?
Sun can be whatever she wants to be, but it's like vaguely. I won't even say like racially problematic, but it's a racial association to be like, ah, the Asian person must know herb lore. And you're like, okay.
Sure. Yeah.
Like this. No, the Sun knows how to find like the best designer scarves. You know, like that's my impression of Sun's backstory. I'm not trying to underestimate her. She's not like full Shannon or whatever. But like, you know, it's like, and I'm not underestimating Shannon either. Anyway, I think I'm just digging my.
I don't think you're wrong. I just don't think we're there yet, because here we have sea anemone and coughing up blood means they're dying. Or like bleeding internally, which I feel could be random knowledge facts for an adult woman, possibly. But you're right that herb lore is weird.
And also some of this stuff is like she's just seeing the obvious answer that Jack's not seeing because he's losing it.
And you know, blood, like losing lots of blood.
Well, and having Boone bite down on the stick, that's a pretty basic thing.
Yeah. Watch it Die Hard.
I do love Sun here. And she's great in this episode. It's a great performance. The other medical question mark I have when we're talking about like slotting people into certain roles, I had, first time I rewatched this, I had an issue with it, and then I came around to, like, some kind of explanation for it, but, like, kind of bothers me that, like, Jin runs back, tries to get Jack to go with him. Jack's like, Charlie's there. Jack's like, I can't go. Obviously, I don't know if you noticed, there's blood coming from me into this body here, so I'm locked down here.
I'm set for now.
I'm staying. You guys go. Here's what you do. Tell Kate. And I'm like, why is Kate doing this when Charlie has the direct download from Jack? Like, why isn't Charlie doing this?
Oh, he knows Charlie wouldn't.
Well, but that's the thing is, like, Charlie's like, you have to do it to Kate. And she's like, I don't want to. And he's like, you know, and I'm like, why does Kate have to do it? And then I was
definitely
like,
they try to weave, they tried to weave, like, almost like a D story about, you know, the trust between Kate and Jack in this episode, but it doesn't really read.
My most charitable explanation this last time going through is that, like, Claire would be more comfortable having Kate do it than having Charlie do it, or having Jin do it. So I was like, okay, maybe it's, like, out of deference to Claire, you know, but, like, if Jack were there, he'd be delivering the baby. So I don't know why it's so, like, sharply gender divided. Kate, you have to do it. Like, Charlie's the one who's, like, spent the most time with Claire. But anyway, Kate does a great job. I love this too. What a great thing to have this death and this birth together. I mean, maybe it's a little too on the nose. I don't know, but I think it's a really beautiful episode.
I doubt just being too on the nose by having it not happen at the exact same time and, like, intercutting the montage. They each get their moment. Boone gets to let Jack off the hook and mumble something about Shannon. Maybe could have used a half an extra moment. But then, you know, we get the baby on the beach. So I think, yeah, it's handled. It's not handled, you're right, as ham-fistedly as, like, a maybe it was reincarnation storyline.
Right, yeah.
But it's a real roller coaster there at the end. Because it's like, it goes from, like, is Jack going to bail on this marriage, to Boone dies, to everybody celebrating the baby, to, oh shit, Shannon's back.
Yikes.
Like, it's a really wild ride at the end of this episode.
Yeah, that's the real D plot, right? Is Shannon and Saeed have a date? Can I give my Catelyn Stark Memorial Ironic Statement Award to Shannon?
Yes.
Shannon says, we're here for God knows how long, and so is Boone.
She says probably around the same time he died.
Yikes.
Anyway. Dark loss. Dark.
How do you feel about the choice of Boone being the first casualty on Lost?
Fine with it. I love the chaos of it, because a lot, and I guess we're going to talk about this in the storm, but a lot of crazy stuff just happened, and we kind of forget about it because of this episode where Boone is dying through the whole thing. Like, a lot of wild stuff happened right at the end there for Boone. You know, the radio transmission that he heard, the plane itself, you know, John Locke's whole deal. And then this episode sort of allows us to forget about all that crazy stuff because it's just about Jack and his obsession with fixing things. So,
it's interesting.
I'm into it.
Yeah. It's interesting to me. Is this where I can, like, read some of these, like, Ian Somerhalder interviews that I've been promising? Okay. So
let's talk about the first actor to be written off of Lost.
So Ian Somerhalder went on to great success with The Vampire Diaries. So we're not, like, crying too much for him. He gave some interviews around his death and afterwards. So, and also if you ever want to go back and listen to our full interviews with Javier Grillo Marxwatch and also with Jorge Garcia, they both talk about Boone's death in this first season. I think Jorge was talking about it in the context of Ian's choice to stick out his tongue when he died. And Jorge thought it was like, it's not like a full, like, stick out, but it's like, he was just saying he really likes the death face that Ian makes there. And he like tells all other actors that he's ever worked with who had to film a death scene, like, you should do this, and kind of like your tongue a little bit, because he learned that from Ian.
Yeah. I wonder what that is. Like, do you think it's just like his face went totally relaxed? Like, if you relax your face, your tongue just kind of lays there.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I'll try it out later. We'll see how it goes.
So they decided to write Boone off after. So they filmed Boone's solo episode, and then they had a hiatus, and in that hiatus they were like, you know what, this isn't really working. So that's when they decided to write him off. So he got a call just like the actors on Game of Thrones get a call when they died. And he told the great Jeff Jensen, Doc Jensen, over at Entertainment Weekly when it happened. He gave an interview and he said, pretty devastating. Thank God I already had 4 glasses of really good Pinot and me. The week before I got the call, I started looking for a house in Hawaii. Now I'm looking for a house in Venice Beach. I guess this is TV history, huh? The first main character to be killed on Lost. So, and he says, in terms of like, playing the death scene, he says, I was spacey and nauseous and a little pissed. It's hard walking a fine line between lucid and not lucid while Matthew Fox is ramming a needle into my chest. So, so there's that. But then you get, and then I'll read a little excerpt from, there's this like Vampire Diaries oral history, that's on Entertainment Weekly that Sommerhalder, contributed to. And he says, when he played Damon Salvatore on The Vampire Diaries, I had just come off Lost. I saw the whole network Dog and Pony show, and I said, I want to be edgier, have fun, and do really cool, weird shit. And I tried, and I fell on my face a few times. I fell off the map for sure. It was a very rebuilding, humbling time. But the one thing I said I wasn't going to do again was some network show. So they sent me this pilot, and I was like, this is Twilight on TV. I have no interest in doing this. And I didn't read it. Cut to, I'm in Vegas with my family. I read it, and I'm like, holy shit, this is amazing. So anyway, so he goes on to do The Vampire Diaries, where he plays this incredibly charismatic, dynamic vampire called Damon Salvatore. He's the fan favorite. Everyone loves him. He's the best part of that show. And then let's cut forward to an interview that he gave in 2015, to the Chicago Tribune, where he says, I often think back to why they killed me on Lost. People like to see conflicted people, but through humor. Humor is a medicine for pain. It's a band-aid. Boone, unfortunately, and this is my fault as an actor, Boone was a little, and then there's an expletive, I don't know what expletive he used, Boone was a spoiled, rich little bastard who couldn't smile to save his life. I'm pretty funny as far as my friends go. They say I'm typically a pretty funny person. Why on earth, living in Hawaii, having so much fun, skinny dipping with our cast 3 days a week, why didn't Boone fucking smile more? So then he says, Sawyer's a great deal of inspiration for his character Damon. Josh Holloway is an amazing actor. Sawyer's a really great character, one of the most conflicted, funniest dudes ever, and I felt that way on Vampire Diaries. At the end of the day, not to demean the material, no, that you don't need to know that. Anyway, so the point is, right, he got killed, he was embarrassed, he feels like he failed as an actor to bring the appropriate amount of level of charisma. Study Josh Holloway, did what Josh Holloway did, but on a CW vampire show, and had huge success. So I think that's like a good lesson to learn from being embarrassed by being the first to be killed off on the show.
Ooh, what do you think he said Boone was? Like a shit? He was kind of a shit.
A C word? I don't know.
Oh, you feel like he went up a level.
I don't know. And the other thing that I will read is this quote that Lindelof gave at the time. He said, the show is about the conflict between Jack and Locke. Boone's death will be a divisive point between them. So,
well, yeah, because Jack thinks it's murder.
Murder. He didn't die. He was murdered. But so this idea that, I mean, let's just say, like, Boone was fridged. This is a fridging of a character. Like, not only were they like, hey, this character isn't working, we're going to get rid of him, but like, we're using his death for how it will affect Locke and how it will affect Jack, and to a degree that they're way less interested in how it will affect Shannon, on that island, you know?
Well, yeah. And, you know, we've been talking about the whole Locke-Jack dynamic, and up to this point, we've been able to mostly explain everything that each of them are doing as like, this is how they're trying to help everybody, or this is how they're trying to help or protect the group. But this really is like, feels like a huge breaking point between them, where it really puts, you know, it's going to put them on opposite sides of things.
Murder.
You can't murder Boone and get away with it.
Let me ask you a quick question. And this is about, I'll just ask you in the comm as much as you can answer in the comm. What do you make of Jack delivering a classic Lockean, don't tell me what I can't do, line reading in this episode?
It's extremely on the nose.
I mean, yeah.
I mean, that's basically where I'm at with it.
Okay.
It feels like a softball after he says it. But when Michael says, you know, he can't, it works. I don't know. It is extremely on the nose, but it also, I mean, Off the Hook did the same thing for me because Rose says that to him, you know, letting Jack off the hook. So I don't know if it reads badly or just my mind is wired for echoed phrases and Lost. And numbers now. Curse numbers.
I do want to circle back to Boone's death really quickly and say that something that struck me this time watching it is we know that they initially wanted to kill Jack in the pilot, and we're kind of told by the network you can't kill the white guy. And I like that they like killed the white guy anyway. Just the like the. Right. The less significant white guy.
We'll get
guy.
Our number two Jack
yeah.
and kill him.
Our faux Jack.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So budget Jack died. But I do like that the first person to die on the island is a straight white dude. I think that's oddly comforting for some reason.
A very not 2004 thing.
And apparently, I don't know if this is like why she's wearing that, but now that Boone's dead, there's 44 survivors on the island, and that's the number that's on Sarah's shirt. So
44, that's 2 4s.
Anyway, yeah, so a great episode, right? Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually think it's, I mean, of the Jack episodes we've seen thus far, I think it's the one that has the best balance between what's happening on the island and what's happening in the flashbacks. I think it might be my favorite Jack episode so far.
Yeah, mine too.
I don't know. I still like All the Best Cowboys Have Daddy Issues.
Yeah, I mean, that one's good.
But I also like it when Jack is just like really stupid instead of just like a good doctor and partially stupid.
I mean, by the end, he lost so much blood. He should have at least known that he was not thinking clearly.
Well, I think, yeah, mild spoilers for next week. We'll get a little bit more of the kind of Jack that I like at the beginning of the episode, which is just charge it into the forest with absolutely no idea what the fuck he's doing. So yeah, it'll be great.
I will buy one of our listeners a pup. One of our, like, if you've never seen Lost before, this is your first time through, and you have not peeked ahead, if you can successfully guess which character the next episode is centered on without cheating, I will buy you a puppy. Also, follow up. This is the second episode in a row that ends on like a major cliffhanger, right? Like this is a big, like, I'm going to find John Locke. You know what I mean? Like that's a big, you know, and so that just seems to be something that they're leaning into in these final episodes of the season, I think.
Yeah, that, I mean, it's been a while, obviously, since I'm still sort of working my way through the whole thing and then looping back, but that feels like a very Lost thing late in seasons. You start to just get just cliffhangered like crazy. Mm-hmm. So, season one, they had that from the start.
Cliffhangered is my favorite Sean Connery James Bond movie. All right, did we do most 2004 thing?
We have not done that yet. Let us do it before we peace out of the calm. Is the most 2004 thing about this episode Julie Bowen's extremely overplucked eyebrows? Is it Jack's pre-wedding yin-yang tank top that has, like, some sort of rainbow fire also on it? I feel like a groom in 2019 would not wear that. Or anyone would not wear that. And then Sarah calls another woman trashy. That feels, I don't know, that feels like a very 2004 thing to me. I feel like we don't call women trashy anymore. It's a very judgy thing to say. So is it Sarah calling another woman trashy? Is it Julie Bowen's overplucked eyebrows? Or is it Jack's pre-wedding yin-yang tank top? Neil, what is the most 2004 thing about this episode?
I gotta go with the tank top. Because I'm all about the weird symbols that end up on Jack.
Yes.
That's all I'm gonna say for now is, like,
yes. I'm sure our listeners have noticed his tattoo at this point.
The spiritual side of Jack is really fascinating to me. So I want to know why he bought that shirt.
Dave, what do you think?
I'm going to have to go with the eyebrows because I both, like, understand it as a 2004 thing when you said it, but wouldn't have thought about it otherwise.
All right. And then two last thoughts before we are done here. Number one is I just want to plant a flag on the significance of the name Sarah. Like, I think if whenever we're talking about the Shepherd family, we should look at the significance of the names. Sarah is a very important biblical figure. So maybe look up Sarah in the Bible and think about what that might mean. That could be fun. And then, the other thing that I want to say, I don't remember when it was. Never mind. Is that it?
Yep. Was it how excited you are for this upcoming interview?
I cannot wait for you to hear me talk to Emily about Do Not Harm. We are thrilled to be joined on this podcast by Vox's critic at large, Emily Vandewerf. Emily, hello, how are you?
Hi, it's so good to be here. I'm delighted to have watched Lost and to be talking about Lost.
Well, usually I sort of have to scramble a little to figure out what to talk to people about when they watch an episode, but you very helpfully laid out some of your thoughts for me just now on Twitter, so I have a little guide of some things that I can probe into in terms of what you're interested in. But I want to start out with the fact that I know that Lost is sort of foundational to establishing you as a critical voice in the TV sphere. So can you talk about that, about your origins with Lost?
Yeah, I was telling somebody on Twitter, and I realized I believe this. There are, of people who've sort of become critics in the 21st century, there are those of us who came up alongside Lost and recapped Lost, and there are those of us who came up alongside Mad Men and recapped that, and then there are those of us who came up alongside Game of Thrones and recapped that, and, like, I'm a total Lost baby. I don't think I covered season one, but I covered most of the subsequent seasons, either at my private blog or at the House Next Door, or a couple. I did some at the LA Times. I did the final season at the Los Angeles Times. And, like, I wrote like a 3,500 word review of the finale, and the copy desk was like, seems okay. We put it online. It's still there. You can read it right now.
Oh, my gosh. I really wish I had read that before I talked to you. that's a sign reading for everyone. Well, everyone who has, watched Lost all the way through. So as you might know, we have newcomers watching along with us. So we try to sort of avoid spoilers as much as possible. Then we'll have a little spoiler section where we can talk with all the restraints off. But in a spoiler-free way, I guess, for people – when you encounter people who haven't watched Lost, either who are professional film TV critics or, TV fans, what do you think they're missing about sort of a fundamental point in the evolution of TV?
Was that a Caroline Framke subtweet?
It was.
Me subtweeting Caroline. Hi, Caroline.
Hi.
I think no show. And I include most of the 2010s shows that kind of built off what Lost did. I would include Game of Thrones in this number. I think no show has done what Lost did as well as it did it. And like Lost obviously is building atop things like Twin Peaks and the X-Files and all of that, but like Lost for me blends all of these like TV movements. And like, this is the worst elevator pitch. Like, you're getting out of the elevator now as I'm saying, look, yeah, but listen, it's the Love Boat.
Wait, come back.
No, it is just like one of the, like, my little pet theories is that the sci-fi shows that really are successful are built atop the structures of other genres. So, like, I've always said, like, Star Trek is a Western. And, The X-Files is a 70s cop show. And Lost is really built atop that 70s travelogue ensemble show, which is why I invoked Love Boat. It's Love Boat on a spooky island. They didn't have new characters coming in every week, but they came in often enough that the ensemble got refreshed. And like, it has in there elements of, and in the episode we're going to talk about, it has elements of other genres. Like, there's a lot of hospital drama in Lost, weirdly. Right. And like in this episode we're going to talk about. And then like, they really turn that into this unique meditation on a whole bunch of different themes, but most especially like atonement, forgiveness, learning to be okay with yourself, which is one of those things that TV was struggling to talk about in the 2000s. I was thinking about the way that people used to like to compare TV to novels at that period. Now we've kind of moved on to, well, it's really a 10-hour movie, you know. But in the 2000s, it was very popular to say, this is the ideal medium to adapt novels or to tell novelistic stories. And like, of course, the chief example of that is The Wire. And Lost is always a little too ungainly to be a novel. But at the same time, like, if you look at a lot of shows with novelistic storytelling, they often feel like they're stretching stuff out. They're taking taffy and stretching it way out. Lost, you feel like it's actively ripping pages out of the book as you're reading them and like throwing them in a fire. And you're like, wait, I wanted to see that. And like, there's nothing quite like that feeling of simultaneously being totally engrossed, totally confused, totally turned off, and just like totally willing to go wherever the show would go. Like, somebody said this in my replies, and I forget who it was, but they said even when it lumbered, it had grace. And like, that's really true. Even when this show was bad, it was so watchable and it was so fascinating. And fortunately for us, we are in the back half of season one, which is about as good as the show got. Like, this section is just TV that goes from strength to strength to strength. You have a lot of that coming up if you are watching Lost for the first time. There are a lot of places where that's true of the show, but here at the end of season one, we're just really like, the show's just really cooking.
Yeah, there was a little bit of a dip. I would say a few episodes back, like Hearts and Minds is a tough one for people. People don't like love special that much, or Homecoming. But then, you know, from like Outlaws, In Translation, Numbers, Deus Ex Machina, Here We Are, Do No Harm. You know, it's a really good shot to the end.
Yeah.
And I felt like I could promise people like there's not a bad episode now till the end. And this is by network TV standards, this feels like an incredibly long season. It's 25 episodes. And I think that supports your point of, you can't call this, oh, it's just a 25-hour movie. I mean, like, this Lost season one defies trying to conflate it with cinema because it's like 25 episodes, and some of it is going to flag and some of it is going to be strong, but that feels more like TV than a lot of the shorter tauter series seasons we get now, you know.
And at the time, I believe Matt Zoller Seitz compared it to one of those Stephen King doorstop novels. And you would later see like the writers be like, yeah, The Stand was a huge influence on us, which you can feel.
Yeah.
It's more prominent. This is not a spoiler, I promise. It's more prominent later in the show, but you could definitely feel it here in season one. Like, the way that this episode kind of sets up Jack and Locke as twin poles of whatever the rest of the season is going to be. Because like, even at the time, people who were watching this episode knew, like, we've only got a few episodes left this season. And, like, so this is clearly bringing, like, this is almost a season finale, but, like, we still have four episodes to go. This is wild. I love it.
It feels like it should be a season finale, but it's not. So really quickly, before I get into episode specific questions for you, I was curious, if you can say this in a spoiler free way, or I guess let's just say looking at season one, what do you see in season one that feels very J.J. Abrams to you? And what do you see in season one that feels very Damon Lindelof to you?
Yeah, so Abrams stepped away after, I think, episode 7. Mm-hmm. So he was there for the first few, and then he had to go make, I think, Mission Impossible 3.
I feel like
that's the timeline here. Of course, with the immortal Kerry Russell. Yes.
No, sadly not immortal in that film.
I feel like that was an important stopping point on the Kerry Russell, like, continuing to be a public figure on her way to The Americans, which I think is one of the great TV performances of all time. So
yeah, and The Americans doesn't happen, I don't think, unless you see Felicity kicking ass in Mission Impossible 3. So
thank you, JJ, mm-hmm. for stepping away from Lost. I do think that this show is cast like a JJ Abrams show. Like, all of the actors are interesting, and there's, like, this is an like, they're all attractive people, but there's an interesting mix of faces. And I mean that in, like, senses of, like, racial diversity, body type diversity, etc., but also just, like, the way that Jorge Garcia processes information, the way you see him think about that is so different from, like, the way Yoon Jin Kim does, or the way that Matthew Fox, not Michael Fox, Matthew Fox does, or the way that, like, Dominic Monaghan does. Like, there's all these different players, and they all just sort of, like, when you watch them, they all have different performance modes and different ways of processing the things that they're hearing, but they all mesh together so well. Like, even the weaker performers in the cast, I think Maggie Grace is a fine actress. She's done good work elsewhere. They never really had a handle on who Shannon was supposed to be on this show, but, like, she's so perfect in that part that you're like, yeah, okay, all right. That's, I think, a really J.J. Abrams quality to it. A lot of the J.J. Abrams has sort of leached out of the show by this point. For lack of a better word, I think J.J. Abrams is really good at poppy stuff. Mm. Like, I think he's really good at big images, big ideas, just big things that you instantly kind of latch on to. Like the big red ball from Alias and the first Star Trek movie is just, like, such a weird image, such a cool image. You just sort of instantly are like, yeah, I love that thing, whatever that is. He's really good at that. I do think that, like, people point to Lost as the ultimate failure of his mystery box approach to storytelling. Mm-hmm. And I'll leave those of you who haven't seen the show to figure out why people would say that. But even by now, episode 20 of season one, you are seeing ways that this show can stretch and stretch and stretch and stretch out a mystery. Like The Hatch, let's say. By this point, we're all wondering what the hell's up with that. Mm-hmm. And, like, it's been going on for a while. But I don't know how fair it is to hold that against Lost, both because he left and because I think the mystery box is inherent to this show in a way it wasn't always on his other shows. And it's hard to talk about that without spoilers, so maybe we'll talk about that in the spoiler section. But I do think the idea of you are on an island where there's weird stuff going on and you don't always know why the weird stuff is going on, like, there is a mystery box appeal to that that is very different from something like I'm going to rag on a show I like. I really like Fringe, but Fringe is a show where everybody could have just had one conversation and cleared up a lot of problems.
Like, right. Yeah.
Pretty early in season one. And Lost, by design, doesn't have a character who can do that in season one. And, like, that is – I think people get frustrated with the mystery box in the show, and I understand why they do. I think it's a misnomer, and I think it's weird to blame J.J. Abrams for it when he kind of left the show behind. Like, it's his most famous TV baby, and he had, like, the least to do with it of all the shows that he directly created. All right, I have to talk about Damon Lindelof too, don't I?
Well, then, yeah, I guess my follow-up question to that a bit would be, like, then is it fair to blame Damon and Carlton, or what does Damon bring once the JJ gets leached out? What does Damon bring in?
So Jack is kind of a whiny little baby. I don't know. I don't know if you all have noticed that who are watching this show for the first time. I kind of love Jack. Mm-hmm. I kind of love Jack. Okay. And I love him even more now that I've been rewatching some episodes recently. There is something about him which is like so petulant about the way the world won't bend to what he wants. It's so white guy, but I think it's a classic Lindelof hero, you know? Yeah. Like Lindelof is really good at creating these white guys who are just like constantly running up against the edges of like whatever it is they want to do and like feeling like, oh yeah, I should be able to do this. And then they're held back. And I think the reason Lindelof is so good at that is because he externalizes forces of mental illness. Like the island in a lot of ways is trauma. The island in a lot of ways is depression. The island in a lot of ways is like social anxiety. Like the island comes to stand in for all of like these deep-seated, hard to grapple with, religious, spiritual, philosophical, psychological, whatever you want to call it, these things inside of ourselves that we can't quite get a handle on. And like, you can feel in the early going of this show that both of the writers were playing with that idea. You can feel that Lindelof was a lot more engaged by it. And that really comes to the fore in the second half of season one. And I think this is an episode where it's like really a big deal. And I think that another thing Lindelof is really good at is turning tiny little events into stuff that feels huge and momentous and emotional. And granted, giving birth to a baby and somebody dying are pretty big events in somebody's life.
Right.
But they are as the basis of an entire episode of a TV show about a mysterious island where there's maybe a monster. Like, that's not where you'd go to. I think that Lindelof's great skill is in finding the human core of massive blockbuster type pop stories. And that is the sort of thing that like a lot of these shows forget to do. Like a lot of the Lost copycats obviously forgot to do that. But even today, like the more that a show trends towards spectacle, the more that a network is like, this show's a big hit, we're going to give you whatever you want, the less they focus on those tiny human moments. And Lost never stopped doing that. And like, Do No Harm in the back half of season one, when this show is as powerful as it would ever be, when ABC would have gladly given them like the Statue of Liberty, they're doing an episode about a baby being born and somebody dying. There's no God damn it. I'm going to take that back and you can edit it.
So we have a beep. Don't worry.
There's no footage of the monster. There's no like big mystery being revealed. We don't find out what's in the hatch. There are all these questions hanging over it. And this episode is content enough to say, okay, we're going to pause and we're going to look at this extraordinarily human thing. This is the year Lost won the Emmy. And this was one of their tapes. One of their tapes was Deus Ex Machina and Do No Harm as basically a two-parter. And yeah. I just can't imagine getting that tape and not voting for this show. It's just like, it is the mystery weird side of the show. And then it's the incredibly intimate and human side of the show. And like, that's what made this show as good as it was. And that's why I still love it.
So there was a debate raging among our first time watchers about whether or not Lost was too safe of a show. And this is, I think because they're, you know, living in a post Game of Thrones era when, you know, by now at least five characters would have killed off. And of course, like the apocryphal story is that, or not apocryphal, the story is that, you know, Lindelof or JJ, they wanted to kill off the Jack character, maybe he'd be played by Michael Keaton. And that would be the big sort of Ned Stark-esque shocker of to kick off Lost. And that the network pushback said you can't kill the white guy protagonist sort of thing. I love that our first major death is like our beta Jack, right? Our Boone who wants to be Jack in a lot of ways. But, you know, this is our first major death. Where are we on the spectrum of like TV deaths on TV? Is Lost a safe show at all. This is maybe something we talk about a little bit more in the spoiler section. Or, you know, how daring is it in terms of TV deaths and how it uses it?
By Game of Thrones or Walking Dead standards, it's, I guess I'd see how it could be perceived as safe. By the standards of 2005 when this aired, granted, killing off Boone is not killing off Jack, but it was a pretty big deal. Like, there were other shows that had killed off major characters. For me, to this point, to the point of 2005, the most shocking TV death is Jack Bauer's wife at the end of season one of 24. Like, that to me felt pretty seismic.
For me, it's Jenny Calendar on Buffy.
Yeah, Jenny Calendar is a big one, but like, here's the thing. If you were a true TV geek, you're like, okay, she's not a series regular. Right. She's probably, you know, and the same thing with like, literally any supporting player on the X-Files, where you're like, yep, okay, because they had a pretty high body count, but, and another one people often cite is like Mrs. Landingham or Joyce Summers.
Right.
You know, both of them were guest stars. Terry Bauer on 24 was positioned as a huge part of the show, and they were like, no, she's dead. She was probably the most important supporting character. Like, to me, that's the biggest just in terms of the biggest risk for a TV death, right? until Ned Stark. So Lost is not quite to that level, especially with the idea of killing off Boone. But I think this show is... I think that this show is unsafe in different ways, which is it is telling, you know, it is almost like I feel like TV deaths don't have meaning. Does that make sense? Like, if you look at a lot of the deaths in Game of Thrones, and this is not me talking shit about Game of Thrones, a show that I really enjoy, a lot of them are just kind of there. You know, they happen, maybe there's a reaction shot, and then it's on to the next thing. And that's kind of the world of that show, so I get why that happens. Lost is a show where Boone dies, but Jack has to be convinced to let him die. The characters have to sit there and wait and react. And, like, we get to watch this protracted agony of what it would be like to have this person die, to have this moment. And then we have to watch Shannon find out, like... We have to watch in silence. We watch this woman find out about her stepbrother, and it's really like a stark and beautiful. And I think that without spoiling, there are other deaths on Lost, and without spoiling, this is a show that always, always, always finds the humanity in those deaths. And that's another Lindelof commonality. That is true of his follow-up show, The Leftovers. I don't know if it's true of Watchmen yet, but I just can't imagine it won't be.
Right. You mentioned on, in this Twitter thread that you did while watching this episode, you mentioned, the act outs, which are, you know, let's go to a commercial sort of thing. Uh-huh. Can you explain what is so powerful about the way that Lost uses that particular aspect of network television?
Now, look, I know that we are moving to a world where, I'm going to talk about a show that has nothing to do with Lost at all. I know that we're moving to a world where commercial breaks are a thing of the past and we don't really need them because everything is on streaming. But I really like the Hulu show, The Handmaid's Tale. And it's weird to say that now because season three was kind of a mess, just kind of all over the place in a very Lostian way, honestly. Mm-hmm. we're like, sometimes this show could be really messy and you'd be like, all right. And I realized watching season three, why one of the reasons I stuck with it, it has act outs. Like, they still have to write to commercials because Hulu still occasionally, in certain ways that you pay for Hulu, you'll be watching ads. So, like, they still had to write to it. Another show from this era that didn't have half commercials but still wrote act outs was The Sopranos. They wrote those scripts so that they had act one, act two, act three, act four. And, like, if you watch the show, you can sort of feel where those would go. Now, the act out, I think, is kind of a missing element of this argument we're now having about we need to have stronger episodes, because I think that's true. I think we do need to have stronger episodes. It can't just be all serialized all the time. One of the reasons I think people love Succession right now, a show I know you enjoy, Joanna Robinson,
I do,
is because it's so episodic. Every episode is like It's like they're like on a bus just going to different places. And like then this week they're here.
I think of it as like a Succession. Sorry, a quick diversion. This week I started to think of it as like little plays, little one acts, because they have so many playwrights on their staff. And so they're like, okay, we're setting this one at this retreat or this one at this country home or wherever we are, this location and all the action, you know, like a drawing room drama almost. It's pretty interesting. So.
Yeah. And like the titles of the episodes are like the location for that. Like, yeah, it's very, it is very like Tennessee Williams in that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, and like that's one of the reasons that show's so praised is because it's so episodic, and like every episode is just a crystal clear piece of writing and directing and acting. And a thing that we've kind of lost in the midst of all this is the act out. And the act out breaks up the episode in such a way that it gives the story an internal momentum. It creates a sense that each act, which is roughly, and we use the term differently in television, it is what airs between two sets of commercials. So each act is its own story. It has its own beginning, middle, and end. And the act out is the end. And that ideally is a cliffhanger that carries us forward. And the cliffhanger can be physical. It can be, you know, something like the end of this episode where Jack says, I'm going to go kill Locke. Or it can be something emotional, like Jack saying, Kate needs to deliver this baby. And ideally, when network television is clicking on all cylinders, and cable's involved in this too, because like FX has to deal with this all the time. And so when TV is clicking on all cylinders and moving toward these act breaks, each act break is a little more exciting than the last, and you get that feeling of the story's momentum growing. And then ideally, all the scenes are building to that act break. And like, I don't think that always has to be the case. Like, Gilmore Girls is a show that always had kind of lousy act breaks, but I think is still a good show. But another show that you're covering on a different podcast, My So-Called Life, there's a show that never has an act out like Angela saying, I have to go kill Tito. But those act outs are so good, because they always leave you hanging on a moment of maximum emotional distress or awkwardness for these characters. And like, so when people talk about act outs, they get stuck in this idea of like, oh, then you're forcing all this plot action. And a lot of bad TV writers use them that way. But in the hands of a good TV writer, they just are such a good signaling post. And they even carry through. Like, I watched it on Hulu without ads. They even carry through when you're watching the show without ads. You get to that point and it's like, Kate's going to have to deliver this baby herself. And then all the horns go, then like, you're right on to the next thing. But like, you still get that sense of excitement that in the old days would carry you through like some ad for, I don't remember what was being advertised in 2005, AOL, I don't know.
Let's say Tide, an evergreen ad. it's interesting. I think I've been so curious, people watching it for the first time without ad breaks. What I do like about these rewatch podcasts, that I've been doing, that a lot of people have been doing, is the forced slowness of them, forcing people to watch week by week rather than, I know a lot of our listeners have either binged ahead or wanted to binge ahead because that's just in our nature now. But this, like, let's take an episode and let's talk about it for a week, is another virtue of Succession or anything that airs on HBO, but it is also just rarer and rarer, currently. So.
Yeah, no, I felt that way when we used to do TV Club Classic at the AV Club.
Yeah.
And we would do one episode a week recap, sometimes like two episodes a week, but yeah. And like, the part of the problem there was people would watch ahead and then they'd stop reading the recaps. And then like, they got such bad traffic that we had to kill a lot of them. Kill, such a bad word. Cancel a lot of them. So just because nobody was reading.
You had to boon them. Yeah,
we had to boon them. We had to like first like give them blood from our own arm, and then we had to like set their bone, and then we had to like amputate their arm, and like everybody else was like leaving because it was so gross and weird, and we were like, no, we could turn this around. And then somebody,
and then finally a son was like, no.
And then and then like the Shield recaps were like, just let me die. We did it. So
what do you think of this episode? Has a flashback structure that I really, you know, sometimes the flashback and the on island stuff gels really well and sometimes it doesn't, but this, of course, we get a pre-Modern Family Julie Bowen, a little bit of Christian Shepherd wisdom, which I always love. And I don't know, I really love this Jack flashback. What do you think?
Yeah. The Jack flashbacks, even here in season one, you can feel where this show is going to over rely on them in a way that is already starting to show its strains. I think the second Jack flashback, I'm trying to remember which one that is, All the Best Cowboys. That one's a little strained. But this one, this Jack flashback, I think is so good and so strong, and like in a really muted, understated way. It's like you get a sense of what kind of doctor Jack was that contrasts with who he is on the island. You get a sense of just how much pain and torment and trauma this man has put himself through in the name of like saving lives, in the name of like his need to be a savior, and how the island has like almost given him that. But it's almost like he sort of misses the ways in which he can be the person he always wants to be. Like the island, by this point in the show, I don't think it's too crazy to say that the island is giving these characters both what they want and what they need, which is sometimes a thing they think they don't want. Mm. And Jack is someone who really, really, really wants to be the leader, wants to be the savior, wants to be the white guy protagonist on a network TV drama. And like, he is constantly being foiled in that attempt because the thing that he needs is to step aside and be a part of this community and not think that everything is his responsibility and his job. But his hubris doesn't let him see that. And like, this episode is such a beautiful example of how you see, oh, here's a good thing that happened when Jack saved somebody. He met his wife, but it's also, he's on the island. He's not wearing a wedding ring.
Right.
We know something happened there. This is a J.J. Abrams thing. Wedding rings, very like key to understanding plotting sometimes.
Okay.
That's an Alias shout out.
Oh, of course. Yes, Vaughn.
Somewhere my wife is weeping about the end of season two. Oh,
I'll talk to you about that in the spoiler section. Okay, go ahead.
That sense of, here he is in this moment when he thinks he can save the day, and he doesn't realize that maybe what saving the day is to let Boone go and to go and help with the birth of this baby. And yet Kate, and I want to say a couple words about Kate, because
yeah,
I feel like season one kind of lets her down. Evangeline Lilly's such a compelling actress and such a compelling presence. And yet you can feel at every turn the way in which this show was originally going to be about her and then was wrested away from her and became about Jack, because she's a protagonist who doesn't have anywhere to protag, you know? Like, she's just kind of like flailing all over the place, and she gets turned into like Sawyer hits on her and Jack hits on her, and that's like the extent of her character. If you go back and read some of the original Lost pitch stuff that's been, you know, leaked around in places, like originally, like she had this like really strong arc that got scattered among other characters, and then they just were sort of like, well, she was a criminal, and yeah, sure, great, cool. But I just, you know, that I feel like this episode really shows what her gifts are, and you can almost see the way that she would have been the hero of this show had the original plan to kill off Jack succeeded. And I think that what happened worked out well, because I do really like Jack. I do think he's a good character. I think it's a little hard to see that right now. I'm speaking with knowledge of where the show goes, but I do feel a little bad for Kate, especially in season one. You can feel how the show was like, we don't quite know what we're doing here.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. And the last thing I want to say about this Jack flashback before we maybe zoom over into the spoilers is, I think this is maybe one of the first times, maybe that's inaccurate, but maybe one of the first times that we know something. Usually we're in the dark, and the show is showing us something about a character, right? Like, I didn't know Michael was actually could have been a good dad if he had been given the opportunity, or, oh, I didn't know Locke's backstory with his dad or whatever it might be. But in this case, we know something about Christian Shepherd because via the Sawyer episode, right, that he meets Christian in the bar. We know this thing and Jack doesn't know it, you know, and so we know that Christian has these regrets about the way his relationship went with his son, and we get to see some Christian Jack stuff in the flashback, and we know more than Jack does. And I think that's a really interesting tension that we haven't quite yet had on the show. So.
Yeah, and that's the thing I think TV does really well is that flip from – because when a show starts, the audience obviously doesn't know anything. Like the audience learns how to watch the show. And I think that what separates great TV shows from good ones often is when they learn to start treating the audience in a way that's like, okay, you understand dramatic irony, right?
Right,
like,
right.
You get that we're dealing with things here. Like, you know more about Jack than Jack does at this point, and we're going to play with that dynamic. And like, Lost, again, without spoiling, starts to do that in some really interesting ways and some really ham-fisted ways. And like, I can't wait for you guys to get to season two because so much of that is in there.
I love that. Now is the time on the show when we like to thank the kind people who make the show possible, our Patreon subscribers. These are our small council members. They get a lot of fun perks, including having their names read aloud on the air. So we would like to thank Tracy, who's a newcomer, John Lillistrom, newcomer, Callum Guy, newcomer, Raymond, Sean Tangeman, Kitsune Lane, Samantha O'Leary, Monica Kay, Kevin Costello, Ian Spiegelblum, Patrick Kelly, Patrick McCracken, Angela Travis, C.A. Sachs, and those are all new folks in the small council level, so welcome all of you. We also want to thank Tyler Hernan, Kurt Klein, Vanessa Marshall, Corey Hilsey, Kelly Grady, and Fanny Martin. Thank you so much.
I, too, would like to thank some folks, starting with Patrick Sullivan, Zachary Silverman, Grace Richardson, Joshua Lane, Bethany Townsend, Danielle, Justin Young, Tasia Pender, Daniel Baltima, Adam Wells, Louise Collins, Michael Filippini, Natalie Muskin-Press, Brianne Polito, Tommy Fitzgerald, Dan Cleland, Michael Belitsky, Lindsay Romaine, Paul Tyrell, and Dre. Thank you all very much.
And I would like to add to our bountiful thanks James Heath, Christopher McGrain, Sean Stringfield, Stephen Weathers, Warpstone, Derek Bachman, Marcus Massarelli, Samba Muteba, Greg Jagger, Luigi Oswego, Nathan Bodner, Stephanie Hoffman, Victoria Stout, Lawrence Aggleton, Jeff Ziegler, Connor Mufich, Amy H., Kate Dilligan, Stacy Taxon, and Debbie DeNice. Thank you guys very much for making this possible. And we're back to talk Stormy thoughts. This week, my main antagonist man, you know, for all we know, is just staring down a tube of light, banging on a hatch for an entire day.
Yeah, where did John Locke go?
Like a moth to the flame.
Where he been? This is that. It's really interesting that they don't.
Straight up hatching.
Yeah.
Just hatching all day.
Hatching a plot. Hatching some schemes.
Trying to build the second trebuchet and being like, this is really a two-person job. Yeah. So this week's Stormy observation from me is that I had forgotten and was reminded through Googling that the Sarah Shepherd car crash kills Shannon's dad.
Yeah.
And so this one,
it's
they're like, go get
connected.
Shannon. Yeah, when they're like, go get Shannon, or get Shannon, or find Shannon, where's Shannon? We flash back to the Sarah speech. So that's supposed to be like a, ooh.
Well, I guess maybe they could have known that at that point. I'm not sure that they did. As our interview with David Fury, that went with Deus Ex Machina implies, in season one, they didn't like have those connections majorly sketched out in that way. The Shannon episode, though, is early in season two, so they might have figured that out already. But I think it's interesting. That came up to me. I actually was reminded of that. Well, not just when I rewatched that episode recently, but also, cause we were talking about how you never meet Shannon's mom or Boone's dad. That's interesting.
Right. Cause we do eventually meet Boone's mom.
Right.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And we kind of meet Shannon's dad.
On a gurney.
So we watch him die, which is a weird way to meet someone.
I was kind of thinking, for all we know, Boone's dad is... Yeah, when we talk about this Deus Ex, like, maybe Boone's dad is also Sawyer. Right? That guy got around.
Oh, you mean Anthony...
Yeah,
Anthony...
I mean Anthony Cooper.
So, right, Anthony Cooper. You know,
good old Coop.
It's all connected.
Well, the connection that I was thinking was funny was that they're like, get Shannon, get his sister, find his sister. She's a blood match or maybe or like whatever, find his sister. And I was like, meanwhile, Jack's sister, Claire, is in medical distress in the jungle, but he doesn't know that. So there you go.
That's something we know that Jack doesn't.
Also, I don't think they knew it at this point, but I do like that, this connects Kate to Aaron from the start, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In my notes, I wrote, Aaron is born for the first time.
Oh, what do you consider his second birth when she...
Well, there's a... Sawyer sees this birth.
Yeah.
And then there is the sideways birth.
Oh, right.
But all of which are important moments for people to observe or be part of or wake up into heaven, I guess. We'll get there. But yeah. So that kind of like came out of my note writing hand before I really thought about it. I'm like, why do I feel like I've seen this baby born a lot? And I'm like, I have at least twice again.
That's true. And I do want to say, like, for all that I was sort of griping about Sun being mysteriously knowledgeable in herb lore, I miss her season one role as Jack's assistant. She doesn't really do that later.
Yeah.
After season one, and I liked that for her. Like, eventually we get Juliet, and so, like, I kind of understand why Sun gets pushed aside there, but, like, why doesn't she get to do some fun medical stuff in season two, unless I'm forgetting anything? But, you know, I like this function for her son. I just wish they could have figured out a way, like, her mom.
Make it like a mob boss. Yeah.
Yeah. Her mom was into herbology or something like that. You know, like something. I don't know. So anyway. Also, yeah, we talked about this before we started recording, but this is such a like dumb fake cliffhanger. I'm going to go find John Locke. And then it's like, nope. No, you're not. Yeah.
Still not good at walking around the jungle. Don't know why I keep thinking I am.
That's one of the things I stop myself from saying in the calm, which is like, this is something they do a lot.
Right.
Like, which is the cliffhanger. It's a cliffhanger you can't trust. I mean, sometimes it works out, but this one is like, oh my God.
Well, I mean, in the sense that last week was also a cliffhanger that you couldn't trust. Like, we're not back at the hatch. We're not going to solve the light in the hatch anytime soon. We're gonna emotionally shift entirely to Boone by the time
the Boone thing becomes a really interesting narrative distraction for the audience, where it's like this, we feel like, you know, we miss a lot of shit right in there. So I think that's really interesting. And again, they were still being very patient at the end of season one, which is part of what makes the show really great, I think.
Yeah, it takes a lot of, you know, self-control, but I think that it pays off to isolate this one episode as, you know, the birth-death episode in the midst of what could have been like a full descent into lore, given where we left off with the plane and the heroin statues and hatch lighting up. They could have like gone directly into the, you know, finale ramp up right there if they wanted to.
Right. But hearing the radio communication that Boone has.
Mm-hmm.
That's all part of the list of Wild's, you know, big narrative ideas they just sort of sprinkled in these episodes.
Then they're like, pause. Did you know Jack used to be married?
Oh, you know what I forgot to mention in the calm? This is what I forgot to mention. It's silly that we don't see Jack's mom at his wedding. It's also silly that we never see her again. They should have just, like recast her after that first episode if they weren't going to use that actress again. You know what I mean? Just recast her. It's fine. But it's deeply weird that we never see Jack's mom again. So.
Yeah.
The other thing, the thing that makes me sad, it makes me sad when Jack says, what if I can't be the husband or the father that I want to be? What if I asked her because I saved her life? Should I marry her dad? Which is a great, like, read on Jack. But when he said it this time, I got really sad because Jack doesn't get to be a father except for in the flash sideways. Mm-hmm. But, like, you know, he, like, rejects being a father to Aaron, which always, like, actually bothered me and seemed out of character for me. But they, I guess they needed that, like, wedge between Kate and Jack or something like that. Like, I just don't think that he would, I think he would totally take to being Aaron's dad.
Yeah, you know what?
Yeah.
I remember thinking that. I maybe even remember having a conversation like that with my mom, being like, because that was, this is a fun Neil's mom story, where she would, you know, she would give Jack a lot of advice. And she was not happy with Jack.
Yeah.
When he didn't sign up to the Aaron Project. So, yeah.
I agree with your mom. But, like, yeah. And some of my favorite Jack stuff actually is the Flash Sideways stuff with his son, David. So, you know, I'm bummed that Jack in, it's nice that in heaven he cast himself as a father. or Heaven's Waiting Room, he casts himself as a father. But it makes me sad that he doesn't get to be a father ever, when that's something that he wanted for himself. But the other,
well, he saves the world, Joanna.
Yeah, well, okay, that feeds into my next question, which is, like, the next line is Christian saying, commitment is what makes you tick, Jack. The problem is you're just not good at letting go. This is such a good line, right? Such a good line, well delivered, such a good, like, deep to the heart of the core of the Jack character line. How do you feel of it, about it as, like, a series long assessment of Jack Shepard?
Yes. I mean, it's spot on, because, like, when you get to season 6 and Jacob's like, someone's going to have to become the new me, Jack's like, all right, here we go, me. And then, like, he knows where that choice ends ultimately for him. So, yeah. Definitely. Jack never lets go.
I also really like this for Christian Shepherd. Like, this is his role, is he's a huge piece of shit as a father. but he gives Jack hard truths. Like, he forces Jack into hard truths. Whether that is truths that lead him to getting, dismedicalized, de-doctored, I believe is the technical term. Or, you know, it leads him to figure out his vows. But he's always there to tell Jack the truth about himself, which is handy for the audience in us figuring out who Jack is.
And maybe, you know, ends up being a little misleading once, you know, he keeps popping up on the island.
Well, yeah, that's a whole nother story.
But at least now we're building trust with Christian Shepherd.
In the real life
shitty
world.
Alcoholic dad.
Yeah.
Well, which, like, you know, if you remember back to All the Cowboys Have Daddy Issues, my argument was, like, you could make that argument that I'm important enough to make the important decisions if you never fuck up. It's, like, when you fuck up that you become worthy of making that argument. You know, I don't know. Like, yeah. Hannibal was like, I'm going to take some elephants across that mountain, and everybody would thought it would be real dumb if you didn't do it. Weird example, Dave, but sure. Finding lots of weird adapters in the mine closet this episode of Storm.
Love that mine closet. I don't know. Is there anything else we want to talk about?
Underrated moment in this episode, which I guess I should have said this in the calm, is when Hurley is about to pass out because of all the blood and how gross. First of all, the Boone... The makeup effect, the chewedness of his body is really gross. So shout out to Lost for getting that on network TV in primetime in 2005. But the moment where Hurley's about to pass out and Jack just straight up, he just yells at him. He's like, if you pass out right now.
Yeah.
Hurley is great when you need someone to react to something. That's the whole thought right there.
And I'm sad Boone died without telling anybody about the radio broadcast, but that's okay because we're in the storm.
At least tell Jack about the hatch.
Yep, and we know we're going to get there eventually, and Bernard will be back, and we'll be so much happier, but there'll be so much more mystery. Guys, until we're back... Oh, wait, no, wait, Neil, why don't you tell me what we're going to be back for? I don't even know.
Well, if you are the person... Well, you're probably not listening this far if you're a calm person. So whichever calm person said it was going to be a Saeed episode, they win the puppy.
Yeah, but like, how could you possibly guess? Because it's awful that it's a Saeed episode. It should be a fucking Shannon episode.
Right.
I hate that the next episode's about Saeed's pain.
It's about Saeed's pain in this whole equation.
Yeah.
Episode 21, The Greater Good, which is, as we mentioned, a Saeed episode. We will talk about it when we next convene.
All right. Until then, where could people find more of your work around the internet? Let's start this week with Joanna Robinson.
You can find me on vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can hear me talk about the TV show Succession on the Still Watching podcast. You can hear me talk about my so-called life on the Boiler Room cast, or award season's just really firing up. So you can hear me talk about that on Little Gold Men.
And Mr. Neil Miller.
Well, you can always get me at filmschoolrejects.com or on Twitter at rejects. And don't forget that if you want to hear more of me talking about pop culture, you get bonus content for this here podcast at patreon.com/stormofspoilers.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E, where I tweet things that I write occasionally. But you can also find me weekly on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, wherever fine podcasts are distributed. You probably found this one at the same place that you could find that one. And every week here on The Storm, the Lost Rewatch podcast, I think it's very important to remind you to not fall down.